Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Very pleased to be with you this Sunday morning. Coming up in the next half hour, we've got Senior Voices and Dayton Youth Radio. And in just a few minutes, we've got a story that arose from our coverage several weeks ago of the new Dayton History Exhibit, the Cold War Discovery Center, detailing the history of Mound Laboratories in Miamisburg. Up first, the story of Wilbur and Orville Wright has been told countless times. To completely self-taught, self-funded brothers invent the airplane in the back of their West Dayton bike shop. The world was never the same. But the story of the Wright brothers' background is even more unorthodox than it seems. In the late 1800s, during the heart of the Victorian era, the Wright brothers' mother inspired their mechanical aptitude. Community Voices producer Leo DeLuca has the story about Susan Catherine Corner Wright.
And here's a quote from Orville Wright. "We were lucky enough to grow up in an environment where there was always much encouragement to children to pursue intellectual interests, to investigate whatever aroused curiosity. In a different kind of environment, our curiosity might have been nipped long before it could have borne fruit." Now, Orville said that in his later years, and thankfully the Wright brothers' curiosity did bear fruit. It bore tremendous fruit. But the Wright family dynamic was definitely atypical. Their father was very loving, very devoted, very encouraging, but he was also a bishop in the Church of the United Brethren in Christ, and his church duties kept him on the road for months. That meant their mother, Susan, was often in charge.
Well, I think the whole family was very dependent on Susan, Catherine, as well as her four brothers. Their reverence for her was remarkable. They thought she hung the moon.
That's Amanda Wright Lane. She's the great-grandniece of the Wright brothers. We met on a beautiful May day at 7 Hawthorne Street to speak. That's the location of the old Wright family home here in Dayton.
So it was always Susan was home. Susan was the mom and dad. And I can honestly say I've never heard of the bishop, you know, picking up a hammer or driving in a nail. So I think it was pretty much Susan and the kids that kept things up around the house.
And Susan wasn't afraid of handiwork. She even built a favored sled for her kids. Now, Susan was born in Virginia in 1831, but her family moved to Union County, Indiana, the following year. She studied literature at Hartsville College, and that was a unique opportunity for women at that time, but she also had a natural mechanical knack. She got that from her father, John Corner, who's been described as a character who did not accept all that he heard or read. Mackenzie Whitmer, who's the program manager with the National Aviation Heritage Alliance, explains.
Susan's father, he was a carriage maker. And so she was around, just in her environment, she was around woodworking, tools, improvising, being creative, experimenting with new ways. It'd be logical to think that that's just who she was.
Yes, but Susan was also a painfully shy woman. Now, that's often the first thing people say about her. Before the Wright family moved to Dayton, Susan was raising her kids alone in the middle of an Indiana prairie. And she was often in poor health. Malaria, rheumatism, and other maladies affected her. But through it all, she had a very positive impact on her kids. She encouraged their interests. She was a light to her children.
While Susan Wright might have been alone in Indiana, maybe physically frail herself, we know that, shy. It was probably really hard, but I hope that the contribution of her children speaks to her legacy, and isn't that all you might want?
Yeah, but Susan never knew she'd leave a legacy. After a near six-year battle, she died of tuberculosis on July 4th, 1889, Independence Day. Wilbur was 22, Orville was 17. Bishop Milton Wright recorded the event. "She expired, and thus went out the light of my home." He wrote that in his diary. But while Susan's death brought darkness to the Wright family home, it can also be argued that it helped bring great light to this world. Following a very serious injury, Wilbur had been in a deep depression that lasted years. But after caring for his mother during her death, he began to think less of his own problems. He began to come to life. Amanda Wright Lane explains.
In the last 2 years of her life, Wilbur pretty much stayed by her side. not only trying to keep her spirits up a bit, reading to her, etc., but doing things that were very practical, carrying her up to her bed. They were sitting here at number 7 Hawthorne Street, and it was a two-story home, and all the bedrooms were upstairs. So I think she was such an encouraging woman and wanted her children to be the most they could be. And perhaps once she was gone, he was able to take the next step in his life. I think it was a transitional period for him to move on then to the next thing, even though I'm not sure at the time he knew what that next thing was, but I believe he was a bit released to begin thinking about the rest of his life.
Of course, the rest of Wilbur's life would bear colossal consequence. So would Orville's. The gift Susan Wright gave her children would someday change the world. But during her life, her impact went unsung. While Wilbur and Orville's mother gave them wings, she never lived to see them fly. For WYSO, I'm Community Voices producer Leo DeLuca.
To see archival photos of Susan Wright, visit our website, wyso.org, and there you can find other stories from many of our great, great Community Voices producers. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend. Thanks for joining us. History also plays a part in our next segment. Recently, Dayton History opened up to the public their latest historical exhibit detailing the history of operations at the Mound nuclear facility in Miamisburg. By all accounts, it was important work, it was top secret, and it was dangerous for the workers, many of whom were exposed to radiation and other toxic elements used at the site. It's a subject that Deb Good-Jerrison knows a lot about. She's the founder of the Energy Employees Claimant Assistant Project, or ECAP. The nonprofit helps energy workers file compensation claims with the federal government. Jerrison started ECAP in 2007 after she began helping her mother with a claim she had filed on behalf of her husband, Jim, Deb's father, who worked at the Mound Lab and died at a very young age. She recently shared her story with us.
My father, Jim Good, was a physicist at Mound Lab. He was there from 49 to 57, and he died in 1960, we thought from Hodgkin's disease, and it was a family tragedy, but that's kind of all. And then in 2000, Congress passed the Energy Employees Occupational Illness Compensation Program Act to compensate workers who'd been put in harm's way without their knowledge or consent. My mom filed a claim in 2001. In 2005, she was just too sick to continue it, so I kind of started helping her and then took over, and it just went from there.
In 2000, was that a surprise to you?
Yeah, because I wasn't following the legislation at that point anyway. My sister knew about it because she was working for Ted Strickland, so she was kind of in at the ground floor.
How much impact did the announcement of that legislation passing have across the country?
It was pretty major among people who had been injured. The one advocate I was just talking to on the phone when you came, I think she was instrumental in helping get the legislation passed, educating congressmen.
And that all took place in 2000, so 18 years. How has your organization progressed, and what kind of involvement are you seeing from folks still affected by this today?
Well, we got my dad's claim paid in 2007, and I used part of that money to start the nonprofit, 501c3, the Energy Employees Claimant Assistance Project. My mother died 3 days before the money went into her account, and she had raised four of us on her own, and she didn't get to use it at all. She said to me, I don't know, a couple months before she died, anything happens to me, don't you let them keep that money. So we refiled as children of a worker.
Tell me a little bit about any memories that you have about the work your dad was doing. It was all very top secret, but what was it like to hear it from Dad?
Well, you know, it never occurred to me until later on that I didn't know what my dad did at work. I remember when I was about 6, I asked him, I said, well, what do you do? And he says, I work with crystals. And he started showing me the shapes of different crystals, and he got a prism out and showed me about how light diffracts, and he got me a microscope. And so he talked around it, but he never talked about what happened there. Mom said there was no pillow talk at all about this. And actually, when I started working on the claim, was the first time I started having any understanding of what he did, because I was able to get a hold of papers that he had written and saw the work that he, you know, was doing on polonium and stuff in the early 50s.
And he passed away in 1960?
Yes.
How old was he?
He was 36. I was way too young.
So you work with others on this project around the country?
Yes.
And tell me a little bit about your structure there.
Well, I set up ECAP as a 501c3 naively at the time, thinking it would help me get some funding. No, that never panned out. But about 2009, I ran across Terry Berry from Craig, Colorado, who was putting out a list on the web for different people, different advocates across the country. And that was a real boon. That put me in contact with people all the way across the country. A little bit after that, another organization, Cold War Patriots, put on a workshop for advocates across the country working in this field. I got in contact with an awful lot of people that way. And I should also say that I am now a worker advocate, paid worker advocate for Cold War Patriots, which is really good to get paid for what I was doing for free before.
Well, that's good. So I imagine that you were quite glad to find that others were taking up this work or had been taking up this work as well.
Oh, absolutely. Before I ran into Terry and the group of advocates, I was quitting once a week because it was just too frustrating. It's such a huge history and such a huge amount of information that's needed, and every claim is different, so you have to find different things for different people. So I would just get so frustrated. But then after I hooked up with them, I probably only quit once every 2 months or so, you know. I have to say, at this point, I'm doing a lot less one-on-one with claimants, although when somebody calls me, I help them however I can. I've been doing a lot of research trying to come up with other facilities that should be covered under the program. I think right now there's 300 and some that are officially covered, and that does not count mines and uranium mills. And there's thousands of those. But in Ohio, I've seen names of different companies that did milling of uranium and stuff that aren't covered. So I'm working on trying to get those facilities covered, to get more people covered that way. There's, you know, Mound Lab. In the 40s, they built a partial duplicate facility in Marion, Ohio. It was called Scioto Lab, and it was part of the Mound family of facilities. It's not covered at this point. That's one I'm working on.
How do you do that? Are you working with the Department of Energy on this?
I start by just doing research. Department of Energy documents are really good. Sometimes old newspapers will give you clues on where to look, although newspaper articles aren't conclusive enough proof. Workers will tell you things, and then you follow those up. But a lot of it's just going through boxes and boxes of documents and trying to find the right one.
You're solving mysteries.
I am, and I love that. it's part of it. You know, it's the Easter egg hunt or the, yeah, mysteries are fun. And this one, I'm afraid, is never going to end. It's just too huge. In Ohio, there have been 21,397 claims filed as of today, that's about 16,000 workers. Some of the claims are for, you know, survivors, people, you know, with their families. There have been 5,882 individuals compensated, $774 billion worth, with $332 billion in medical bills. That's the other thing about the program. It not only provides compensation for the workers, but it provides medical care, whatever is needed for illness that's been approved. So that can be just life-changing. I have a cousin who worked at Mound. She got Parkinson's disease from being there and the work she did. Department of Labor approved her claim, and she now has 24/7 home care, you know, so that she can have the best life she has left.
I don't even think, would this even be the tip of the iceberg, or how?
I'm afraid not. Okay, there have been 300,000 claims filed for the country at this point. And we know there was at least 750,000 workers. So as unbelievable as it is, even after 18 years, you still run across people who haven't heard about the program.
So this was, you know, a pretty important project and time for the country. A lot of people involved, many communities like Miamisburg with Dayton history are staking that claim to the historical aspects of this. Do you feel that it's okay for communities to claim this part of history, but also need to address some of the damage that was done?
I think it's always best when you have a history to put all parts of it in. And the people I've talked with who worked in this industry are extremely proud and patriotic of what they did. But there was damage done. I think we need to acknowledge that because we don't want it to be done again. There's still people being injured at Hanford in Washington State doing the nuclear weapons work. It's still possible for people to be damaged with accidents at nuclear power plants. So I think it's good to see it all, because if you push part of it under the rug, then, you know, it's just not good.
Well, Deb, thanks for speaking with us, and good luck with everything.
Thank you very much.
Deb Good-Jerrison is the founder of the Energy Employees Claimant Assistant Project. She was kind enough to supply us with some links to some helpful websites for energy workers or family members who believe they may have valid claims to file. Check it out on our website at wyso.org. Millie Lyons was just a year old when her dad died in 1923. Her mom was left with five young children. There was no social security system back then, and Millie's mom needed to work to support the family. Millie says her earliest memory is being in a crib at the Pythian Children's Home in Springfield. It was a tough start, but she and her siblings found plenty of ways to have fun.
Okay, I was raised in an orphanage. It was in Springfield. I had three sisters and one brother. And we didn't appreciate it then, but it was a beautiful, beautiful building. We had a wonderful playground and swimming pool and had a large basement. We would skate round and round, play tag in that basement. And we also would sled what I thought were large hills. Turned out later to be quite small, but I can remember a lot of fun sledding. We had our own theater, and we had our own band, and every Sunday afternoon in the summer, we would have a band concert outside. And of course, Mother was always up every Sunday. She brought candy for us and clothes and things. She always saw that we were taken care of. In fact, at one point, they had to ask her to quit bringing us some nice clothes because we were better dressed than the others. We went to public school. The early grades, the school was right down at the end of our driveway. When I entered the first grade and I got tired, I just put my head on my desk, went to sleep. So I flunked the first half, but I still graduated at 17. When I got ready to go to high school, I left Springfield. I was probably an average student, but I did win a contest, which nobody's probably ever heard of, and that was a posture contest for the schools in Dayton. I practiced and practiced walking and holding my head high, my tummy in, my shoulders back, and I won first prize. I got a little miniature statue, and my heart was broken when a boyfriend and I were jitterbugging, and we knocked it off of the shelf, and it broke. I was almost 15 when I left the orphanage. One of the fellows, which was raised in the home for a while, he was a member of the big bands, Freddie Martin. I'm sure some people will recognize the name. And whenever we had our reunions on the 4th of July, and all the kids would come back home, and his band would play for our reunions. We had a lot of good times. I think there were more happy times than sad times there.
On this Mother's Day, that was Millie Lyons speaking with Alan Steiger as part of the Senior Voices Project. This interview was edited by Community Voices producer Katari Costa. Senior Voices is a collaboration between the Dayton Metro Library, Rebuilding Together Dayton, and WYSO. The series is made possible through the generous support of the Del Mar Healthcare Fund of the Dayton Foundation. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend. You know, immigrants live with their feet in two worlds. One stands in tradition, and one stands in exploring American culture. Today's Dayton Youth Radio story touches down in both worlds. Here's project coordinator Basim Blunt.
There's a large Turkish refugee community in Dayton. Some were exiled from Russia several years ago. For today's youth radio producer, balancing the old traditions with the new is doable. Until one family, a big one, showed up for tea.
My name is Miriam. I am 17 years old. I go to Steyer School for the Arts. I was born in Russia, raised in the U.S. Many immigrant families know how difficult it is to grow up in America. I had a tough time learning English because I spoke Turkish fluently. When I have to translate for a family member or even my parents, some words just don't translate right, and my mom always gets mad at me and says, "You're the one who goes to school, and yet you can't even translate." One of the things I dislike about my culture is young marriage. My great-grandma got married when she was only 13 years old. In my culture and in many other cultures, the family of the guy comes over to the girl's house to see how respectful the girl is and what her attitude and personality is like. But when many of my family comes to have dinner and tea, my aunts always start up a conversation about me getting married and how my time has come because I'm graduating. She would start off by asking me when I'm getting married in a joking way, but then she would have a serious conversation with my mom. Now, my parents are different, and they're all about me going to college and getting my education before I get married, but some Turkish families aren't. When I was 15, one day we had guests over. I have never met them before, and literally the whole family came. There was a mom with two kids, a son that was a couple years older than me, and a daughter that was about my age. There was also the grandma of the family. She was the elder. I can't be rude to them because we have to show respect to older people in general. We all ate and had conversations, and when the evening was over, the grandma had asked me to help her put her shoes on. She was pretty old and had on a floral dress. She also had on a headscarf. She gave me a hug and whispered into my ear that they were going to come back to ask for my hand in marriage from my family. At first, I was shocked and a little scared. I'm only 15, I thought to myself. But my dad was right behind us and heard the whole thing. My mom had no idea until I told her, and my dad thought it was just funny. There is a big community, a big Turkish community in Dayton, and I feel like a lot of the young girls there have been through something similar. I think it pressures girls into getting married early because they think that if they don't, then they'll never get the chance to. I'm not going to get married young. I'm going to graduate soon and go to college. I feel like we should be able to live our lives and get our education and then decide when we want to take that big step into marriage. I want to let those girls know that there is an opportunity to live your life the way you want to. Girls shouldn't be forced to marry no matter where they live. This is Miriam Mustalova for Dayton Youth Radio.
That's No Country for Teenage Brides, written and produced by Miriam Mustalova, a senior at Stuyvesant School for the Arts. Special thanks to Leslie Rogers and Eva Max Studis. To hear more stories, visit WYSO.org or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basim Blunt.
Support for Dayton Youth Radio comes from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation and the Ohio Arts Council. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the second week of late spring, the fourth week of the swarming termite moon, and the third week of the sun in Taurus. My furnace is in the attic of my house, and it's a place that's always warm in the coldest weather. During the late winter and early spring, I plant seeds under grow lights there. Geraniums, petunias, castor beans, calla lilies, bananas, dahlias, and tomatoes. The warmth of the lights in the air helps them to sprout, and the spring green of their leaves always makes me feel good. Last year, when I did my attic gardening, I found a stink bug crawling around on the table where I do my planting. I had heard very bad things about stink bugs. No one seemed to like them. They were supposed to smell bad. They were said to be invasive. Some sources said that stink bugs produced thousands of eggs and took over houses and gardens, causing squeamishness, even damage. But I watched my stink bug and I saw that he appeared harmless. Actually very vulnerable. Once he fell off a leaf and lay on his back kicking until I picked him up and set him on his feet. I smelled my fingers then. No odor, really. This year, another stink bug, or maybe even the same stink bug, who would know anyway, watched me plant seeds. I wonder if he had lived there by himself for the past 12 months. I looked around to see if there were more stink bugs. I found one more, but no more than that. He must be wise, I thought, to survive in the attic. I named one stink bug Solomon, of course after the famous wise king, and the other Sheba, after the queen of Sheba, who, according to the Bible, was quite interested in that king. But I wasn't really interested in learning the gender of either bug. Like, who would care about the sex of something like that in their attic? Well, while some people have told me that they are overrun with stink bugs, I feel that my stink bugs are good company. My attic is low and cramped. No one has ever joined me planting seeds up there. I reflect that insects are under siege throughout the world these days thanks to pesticides and global warming. I wonder if perhaps these two stink bugs are hiding with me from dystopia and Armageddon. They have apparently not mated or had offspring. Perhaps they don't want to bring new creatures into such a hostile world. But anyway, what other pet would be so unobtrusive? Keep me company without destroying my solitude. Require no maintenance, no food, no anything. Stink bugs are supposed to be pests, but mine are friends. They should be taking over my house, but they share without the least demand and allow me more than enough room. Best of all, Solomon and Sheba do not fit the mold. They do not act like the fabled stink bugs of Orkin or Terminix. They do not follow the entomological script. They follow their own counsel. They could be overrunning my house, lascivious and prolific, but they're content to bask in the nurturing warmth of grow lights and contemplate the luminescent May green of the sprouts. Solomon and Sheba have, it seems, found the path. They might even be trying to show me their secret, so I will see. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the third week of late spring. In the meantime, of course, find a stink bug and see if he or she will share the secret path of happiness. And to follow May and June day by day, my daybooks for those months are available on Amazon.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide. including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Coming up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.